When you come in on Monday and you're not feeling real well, does anyone ever say to you, sounds like someone has a case of the Mondays?
No. No, man. Shit, no, man. I believe you get your ass kicked saying something like that, man.
A podcast by two developmental psychologists, four developmental psychologists, and everyday folk with an interest in infant and child development. I am Candy LaPan.
And I am Dion Benton, and this is the It's Innate podcast. So today we actually welcome Dr. Lisa Scott. Lisa is a full professor at the University of Florida, where she is the PI, or principal investigator, of the Brain, Cognition, and Development Lab. Lisa received her BS in child psychology from the University of Minnesota, Twin Cities, with a minor in neuroscience, and her PhD in child psychology, also from the University of Minnesota, Twin Cities, where she was advised by Dr. Charles Nelson. The primary objective of Lisa's research is better to understand, like how I didn't split that infinitive, is better to understand how experience influences learning from infancy into childhood, and in particular, how infants become perceptual experts. To this end, she has studied the relation between perceptual narrowing and cortical development in infancy, face processing in young children, as well as the top-down influences of visual experience, which we will be talking about today. To address these and other questions, Lisa uses behavioral measures, eye-tracking methods, and measures of brain activity, for example, event-related potentials. So thanks for coming on the podcast.
Thanks for having me. This is fun. I was so excited when I first saw that you all were starting this. So. Yay.
Awesome.
I'm happy to be here.
Yes. Awesome. We're so excited to have you. And this was like, I hadn't read any of your work before this. And so Dion like opened my eyes to some really cool new stuff. So I can't wait to chat about it later today.
Yeah. So what we're going to do in this episode, kind of like we do in every episode, is we're going to open up with a hot topic. So today's hot topic is student reviews. But I guess before we get into the hot topic, we'll open up with a question that we'll sort of ask Lisa. And hopefully she'll indulge us. And the question is, simply, can you tell us a little bit about yourself? You know, where did you grow up? What got you into developmental psychology? This kind of thing.
Sure. Yeah. Well, I grew up in Minnesota, near the Twin Cities area, which is maybe not surprising since I did my undergrad degree in Minnesota and my graduate degree in Minnesota.
I'm not from Minnesota, but I'm like doing the whoop whoop because I also did my undergrad and grad work at the same place. So I feel like a special connection already.
Yeah. Yeah. So I did my work at the Institute of Child Development, which is a little, different from a lot of schools and psychology departments where they have just a few developmental psychology faculty. Here we have at Minnesota, we had a whole department of child psychology and a whole undergraduate major in child psychology. And so I would say that a lot of my interests in the academic side of child psychology came from being an undergraduate and taking a lot of child development courses and learning just a lot about child development beyond just intro to developmental psychology. So I think that's probably, the where I came from, but my whole life I've always liked kids. I've always, I used to babysit, I used to work at a before and after school program, so there was always some aspect of child development that I was interested in. But I think really being an undergrad at ICD was probably the most motivating. I got opportunities to do research in multiple labs as an undergrad. And so I think that was probably...
It sounds like a really rich experience and opportunity to get into dev psych so much, even in undergrad. That's a really, really cool experience.
Yeah. Yeah. It's really wonderful. I look back, I know that grad school is not always a happy time for everyone. And there were definitely... times where I was a little bit stressed and a little bit But I have to say that community is a really warm and welcoming community, and I really enjoyed my time there as an undergrad and as a grad student.
Is that also a Minnesota thing? I feel like my stereotype of Minnesotans is that they are very friendly.
And the Minnesota nice. Yeah, yeah. No, I think...
Is that a thing? I didn't know that.
It is a thing. It's a thing, yeah. The Minnesota nice. Yeah,
they're nice people in Minnesota. Okay.
Well, you know... sometimes it can be used in a negative way, and in the sense that you're always nice, even when you shouldn't be nice.
To a fault, right.
Too nice.
Well, hey, if any undergrads are listening, I think Lisa hit on something that's really important. If you aspire to eventually become a scientist, a developmental scientist, get involved in research and get involved in the field early. That was true for me. That clearly was true for Candy. And, you know, it doesn't hurt. Find your nearest lab. Find the lab nearest you. Right. Right.
Well, awesome. That's really great, yeah. Lisa. Thank you for telling us a little bit more. I didn't know that about your university.
Yeah.
So now that you have been on the other side, that's the transition, right? Of like then getting on the other side of not being a student anymore. It's a whole different world in perspective. How do you feel about this?
I've been on the other side for a little while now, and I've been at two different institutions. So I did a postdoc. So I did my postdoc at the University of Colorado, an adult cognitive neuroscience lab with Tim Curran. And then I was assistant and associate professor at the University of Massachusetts in Amherst before I moved to Florida. And I've been at Florida for 5 years now. So I've been out for a little while now on the other side of things. And I'm starting to kind of forget what grad school was like, although recently in quarantine here, some grad student friends of mine, when we were in grad school, we're all kind of getting together on Zoom and rehashing all of our camping trips and our memories that we that we have. So anyway, it reminds me of how much fun we had, but I sort of have blocked out the stressful parts of it, I think.
That's a common theme. So one of the podcasts I listened to is A Very Bad Wizard or Very Bad Wizards. And they had an opening where they were talking about just this, about how, you know, they blocked out pretty much most of grad school. It's like hazing. You just sort of block it out. But yet, like when people ask you about it, it's like, oh, it was the greatest experience. But really going through it, it was sort of, it could be hell.
Some parts, not so great. Yeah. I feel like I remember more of the beginning, and then like the last year and a half to 2 years are very fuzzy of just like, mm-hmm. Nope, I don't think about that. I don't want to remember.
Oh, that's interesting. I was the exact opposite. I remember very little from the beginning. And then most of my, you know, what I remember, maybe there's a bit of a primacy effect going on, but most of what I remember is, you know, toward the end.
Yeah.
That's when really research got interesting for me, at least.
Mine was then I was just like in writing hell, right? Like once dissertation data was collected, and then it was like, now just write every day forever for all of time.
Well, getting my PhD with David Rackeson was writing hell the entire time because he's very particular about writing, which is great, actually. It's a good thing. Like, that's where he beat into my head, do not split infinitives, and do not end sentences with prepositions, and short, because I can be a bit wordy.
No.
And so, like, one of the...
I can't ever imagine that. Sounds like we had the same problem, though.
Yeah,
but see, now we're on the other side. Now we get, instead of getting feedback from a graduate advisor, we get feedback from our students, which is, like... is a very different experience, and that was like what we wanted to chat about today as our hot topic.
Student reviews.
It's a very strange transition, right? Like you're used to getting criticism and feedback from like people in these higher positions of power that are training you, and then all of a sudden you get on the other side of it. And whether you've been doing it for a couple years or many years, like you have, Lisa, I'm sure you probably have like some feelings about what it's like when you go and look at that student feedback. Like that, it could be a rough
experience. I guess the question I would have for you, like a specific question, is, you know, Does student feedback play any role in how you go about prepping for subsequent semesters? You know, do you take the feedback into account, or is it sort of like, eh? I ask because lots of, you know, there's a lot of variance.
Oh, yeah.
Variability in, and one's reception and one's willingness to integrate what they hear in the feedback into one's course preparation. So I thought it would be sort of interesting to ask someone who's been doing this for a little bit.
Yeah, I do, definitely. What I do two things that I think, or three things that I think are pretty helpful for integrating student feedback and trying to better understand student feedback. The first is I just very simply print out a syllabus at the beginning of the semester, bring it with me to every single class and take notes on the syllabus about things that they brought up or think questions that they had, or, you know, sometimes things like, well, this reading was not that great and there's a better reading, or have, you know, and things like that. So I just take notes on the syllabus, and that's helpful for just kind of taking the feedback that is not formal feedback, but just kind of informal feedback in the classroom. The second thing I do is then at the end of the semester, I print out all the reviews and I staple them to that syllabus. And sometimes I read them and sometimes I don't, because I'm not teaching that class the next semester. So sometimes I will just put it in a folder and then I'll read it when I'm prepping that class the next time I teach it.
Yeah.
And that's just the verbal feedback. The you know, the numbers and things like that, yeah, you have to submit for review and all of those, you know, parts of academia that we are subjected to, but
reviews.
I think that, you know, the other thing that I do that I think is really helpful for me is to have a mid-semester review where I have a questionnaire. I just ask how things are going. I ask, you know, what I can do better, and then I address those reviews in class, and I talk about what I'm going to do to try and make things better.
Yeah.
So I do think that the students oftentimes have really good points. Sometimes it's, you know, it's a little bit
ad hominem hard
to take. Yeah. And sometimes, you know, I would say if I feel attacked, I tend to take those reviews less seriously.
Sure.
Because I think, you know, I feel like it should be pretty respectful.
Now, are these reviews anonymous?
They're anonymous.
Oh, okay, I was going to say, because I do know of some, I mean, these are the minority, but I do know of some folks who will attach names to the review and then will go back and look at their grade and sort of use that. And so, like, if a person gets, like, you know, a low grade and they, you know, they're particularly harsh, sort of like, well, this person, there's an explanation for why this person may have given me such a bad review. And so there are some folks who do that. Now, they're the minority, but I do know a few people who do that.
That's crazy. Yeah. No, we do all, I mean, all of our, obviously, university ones are always anonymous. They have to do them now through, like, an online system and everything, and it, like, completely anonymizes all their data. But I do mid-semester ones, too, and I started doing that because, like, it's so hard, like, the first couple times that I ever got student evaluations, and I was like, why didn't you tell me this? Like, it was something that they would give me as a criticism. Like, I would have done something about that, but nobody ever said anything, and then it's like, by the end of the semester, class is over, it's too late. Like, now I can't do anything about this. So, yeah, I started doing that, too, and really basic, just, like, a few questions, like, what do you really like? What's going well? What's not going great? What could I do to help? And I find that students just, like, they find that so helpful. Or, I don't know, like, they just, it makes them feel like they're really being heard in the class. Even though, like, I feel like I always know what their feedback is going to be. Like, I don't know what type of classes you teach, but we teach, I'm at a very, like, small teaching-focused institution, so, like, every time, I always know, students are going to be like, we want to do more fun activities in class. Like, it's going to happen. They're going to ask for it, like, every time. And I'd be like, that's great. I will try to incorporate more fun activities into class.
It was you who actually gave me the good advice of, like, well, actually, I'll let you describe the advice. It was really clever, actually. And I thought, I'm going to integrate that in my own courses.
Well, I thought about this from a psychological perspective, and knowing from, like, education research that students are happier and do better if they feel some sense of autonomy in the classroom, like that they have a voice and people listen to them. And so some things like that, I just always know students are going to say. And so I sort of will have some things that, like, the big thing right now is Flipgrid, right? Do you use Flipgrid? Have we heard of this? We all know what this is. Okay. So Flipgrid is like an app that you can integrate with Canvas, and it's basically like posting video discussions. So instead of like typing on a discussion board, students like record a little clip of themselves like doing the discussion. And inevitably, every time I've used this, I get some student comments that are like, I hate doing Flipgrid. I wish that I could just type a discussion post. Whereas like other students, the majority of them love it, but a couple of them always hate it. So for me, that's like, I do the assignment the same as I always would do it, but I also have ready discussion board posts that when they give me that comment, I'll be like, you know what? I'm happy to accommodate you. Like, here you go. Here's the discussion board post. And now students feel like they've been really accommodated. And it's like,
wow, she's amazing. She's receptive. She's quick.
Like, oh, she's no problem with it. Like, it doesn't really matter to me if you record a video or type it out. But like, if it makes students feel like, you know, I'm willing to accommodate them, then it actually, I think, does a lot of good for them. And then they feel like, you know, their faculty really care about their preferences in the classroom. And so, I mean, like I said, normally every time I can predict the certain things that students will stay. So it gives you a little bit of preempting.
The key there, though, is to have two options that you've already prepared.
They're already ready.
And then give them the second option, right? So that to them it's like, oh, she's making up this whole new option, but really, exactly,
it's
right.
It's already there.
Right. And you've already done the work.
And so. But then if I get one class that like I think one of my sections over the summer, nobody asked for that. And then I didn't have to do it. And then like, I didn't have to create another assignment and go back and forth between two separate assignments and like read your discussion posts and watch people's videos because nobody wanted it. So it's like, it ends up working out, I think, best for everybody. So that's my approach.
It's a very developmental psychology, like giving kids choices where there's obviously like they think they have a choice, but really they don't have a choice.
You can have broccoli or can have broccoli, you know, with cheese on it
Yeah, exactly.
Either way, you're going to have broccoli. Just choose between
the options.
You're going to
do, yeah, exactly.
Right.
Like, you still have to do the discussion post. You might write it out. You might record a video, but, like, you have to do that part.
Yep.
Yeah. But see, now then, the other thing, I don't know if you've experienced this either, Lisa, is some of those, like you said, like, if you feel like a comment was inappropriate, I mean, I always get a couple of those, not many of them, but, like, some that are, you know, just a negative, like, really attacky type of comment. I don't take those seriously in terms of like incorporating feedback.
So what would be an example of, if you don't mind sharing, what would be an example of like,
I'll first start with one, which is outside of a tacky, but in another realm, which is number one, if any student comments on my physical appearance, I'm not listening to anything that you have to say, just like full mm-hmm. stop. Nothing that follows after that will be considered in my, like, I just throw that out completely. And I actually tell students that ahead of time now, which I have found makes a big difference. Just generally telling them, like, I'm like, hey, like, you know, these evaluations, I will read them and take them seriously, but that means, like, be professional. This isn't, like, a time to be rude or to comment on things that are not relevant to class. And, like, if you do that, I won't take it seriously. But if you give me a real, like, thoughtful criticism, then I will take it seriously. So that has helped over time. But yeah, so I've had those comments, which are creepy and weird and like not good. And then more like attacky things, just like, I hate this class, or like, this class is really boring and stupid. Like that type of response. What I preempt students with there is I give them that as an example. I'm like, if you hate this class, that's great. You can tell me that. But if that's all that you say, I can't make it better because I don't know what you don't like about it. You just said like, oh, this is the shittiest class I've ever taken. All right, cool. But like, don't know how to make it better for you. So I tell them like, give me concrete, like, you know, I need more guidance on how to write these papers, or I would like more fun activities in class, or like, what is it? Like, give me some concrete feedback. And I think that like giving them more of that scaffolded instruction has helped out a bit there. But yeah, those types of things, just really rude.
What about for you, Lisa?
Well, so more recently I'm teaching a lot of graduate level classes. So the feedback that I'm getting is much more helpful and respectful. And, I think, so I don't have a lot of recent examples of anything, but I do know when I taught at UMass, I taught this 470 student, large lecture developmental psychology class. And 470 students in person. And in that case, that was really difficult for me because I was up on a stage and I just, I remember having this mid-semester review where people from the Center for Teaching came in and they were like, well, you might want to take some acting lessons. And I'm like,
what?
Really? Do I have to do that? But, some of the feedback you get in those large courses, you're always going to get, mm-hmm. some students who just are not really happy with the class or the content or the tests.
Acting lessons, though.
That's a bit harsh.
Yeah. And so I think that there's, I got some reviews there and I still remember, getting the midterm assessment and then saying, okay, now I'm going to address these things in there. And one of the things that they said is that I say ah and a lot. And I was thinking about it. They recorded me, and I watched it and I was like, oh, I do say ah and a lot. And I didn't even know that I was doing that. And it was that I had to look back onto this huge screen to see what was coming up next. And then I, had used these fillers. One student rose his hand and said, I counted, and one day you said it 273 times or something like that. And I remember thinking, all right, well, I'm glad that you're listening to the content of what I'm teaching, right. and not starting a game, But it was true. It was really true. And so since then, and I think with feedback in general in academia, feedback that you get from grants and feedback that you get from papers and reviews and your reviews from your, department committees and all of that, mm-hmm. Academia is filled with critical and negative feedback. And it's just something that over time, and I think with a lot of mentoring from other people, I've learned to just be okay with that for the most part and see it as a way to make things better. Of course, I got some grant feedback and I thought, well, I said that in this grant, right? But then I realized I only said it once. I only said it in this one little paragraph and it's a really important point. So I probably should have said it four times.
Right.
Yeah. So they really get it. So a lot of times the feedback, even though it feels, bad,
yes,
mm-hmm. you can use it to make it better. And when things seem like they're attacking you, I always try to think of the person as like suffering from some disease or something like that that made them in a really bad mood. Not that I am wishing that, but I'm their situation, like they just got in a car accident,
like doing or doing perspective taking. Yeah,
anything like we should be. That if it was happening to me, I might be like, this paper sucks, something like that. Because I do think that a lot of us, especially right now, are going through, or trying to adjust to this new normal. And it's hard. And I feel like sometimes things can pile up and then we're short with people or we're short with our reviews or we don't take the time that maybe we should have for some things. And I see that, probably students and faculty and, grant reviewers, everybody is doing that. So that's kind of my take on it. I try to take a different perspective. I know it's hard, but it has made it a little bit more tolerable to just use it to move on.
I think there's like a really good in between when I think about student evaluations where Like, there's some people on one extreme that are like, I don't even, I've literally heard faculty that'll say, like, I don't even read my student evaluations anymore. I don't care. Like, I'm not paying, like, they're not going to tell me how to teach. And then there's people who, like, it's, it, you take it so personally, and, like, that's the end that I started on, was, like, is, although I'm very used to getting negative criticism, there's something, like, especially emotional about getting, like, negative criticism of my teaching. So at first I would just, like, wallow in it. Like, I couldn't stop thinking about it. I would, like, feel so bad. And so I've done all these things that we've sort of talked about, and to try and, like, get to the middle point where, like, you take the, you read the feedback, you can X-nay some of it that's, like, really just outrageous, or, like, people that are like, I don't think we should have to read for this class, or, you know, there's always some, like, really out there criticism. But take this feedback that is meaningful. And, like, I have improved a lot of my classes and changed things in my classes that I think have made them better because of students' insights. And that's including some big things. Like, one of my classes was, like, I changed my entire textbook because it was so, it was such a terrible textbook. Like, I mean, I sort of noted that on my own, like, it was dense even for me, but, like, students were just like, I can't stand this textbook, it's terrible, like, I don't understand it, it's not organized, it doesn't make sense, and I've had no complaints about that since I switched to a different one. So, yeah, just finding the good parts in it.
That's generally good advice, and, you know, especially like Lisa was saying, when it comes to our own academic work, you know, we get reviews through the form of grants, we you know, we submit papers. And I'm like Lisa, whenever I see a negative comment initially, I'm like, well, this person clearly didn't fucking read the article.
I'm like, I said that.
Yeah, exactly. I said exactly that here. If you just, like, if you squint and turn your head to the right, you'll be able to see it, right? No, but I've gotten better. I'm, of course, still early in the game, so to speak. But, like, I've gotten much better about taking a step back and trying to sort of divine the useful pieces of information, the useful advice, and then integrating that into the next revision, right?
But see, you're going to be more open to that, and it's easier when it's like reviews, because then when it comes from students, I think that they're, for some people, it's like this power dynamic, and they're like, oh, who's my student to tell me how to teach my class?
That's the point I was going to say. I think what makes getting negative feedback from a student, now I'm speaking from personal, sort of from a personal perspective, like, I can imagine that what makes that one particularly difficult to swallow is that, like, who the fuck is a student? You know, like, I am the expert. I am the one who is instructing them. Like, who are they to comment on the structure of the course or the content of the course? But I think even there, you know, there are things that can be learned.
Oh, yeah.
Like Lisa was saying, even if, like you were saying, most of it you can sort of just sort of ignore because you realize that it's coming from probably not a kind place.
Yeah, or not.
But it's a fine line. It's a fine line.
I think that, like, you know what's funny too is that we think that way too, where we're like, we're experts. So I'm like, I'm an expert in the content, but most of us aren't experts in pedagogy. So, like, none of us are really experts in this anyway, because, like, so many faculty don't get training in actually teaching. So it's just like, it's like finding an in-between place where you can try to extract some feedback, even the most quintessential thing, right? Just like in a review, why are they asking me that? It's in the syllabus, it's on Canvas, and I find myself thinking this a lot. And sometimes, not always, sometimes it's just they didn't read it. But other times I found, like, when I get those questions and then I look back, I'm like, oh, like, yes, this was in the syllabus, but, like, mm-hmm. I didn't really clarify it enough, or, like, me. And I've even there found ways that I could make things so, like, I get that question less in the future, or, like, where I put it on Canvas or something like that, you know, where you can sometimes take from that, like, the annoying question you keep getting over and over again. Well, then what could I do to stop getting this question rather than just blaming students for being lazy?
Right.
Yeah.
But the other thing I've noticed with teaching, though, is that a lot of times I'm not the expert on what I'm teaching. So a lot of times I, especially with grad classes, like, sometimes the grad students know much more than I do on a topic that I'm teaching. And so I tend to try and have the perspective that, going through that course is more of a collaboration. And there are going to be some things that I am the expert on, but a lot of it I'm not the expert on. And if you have something to say, or you have, things to add, I think that's a great part of, like, a collaborative discussion. And that's the perspective that I try to take with grad students. and even with undergrads at some point in time, because a lot of times they have very different experiences, and they come from different backgrounds, and they have really, really interesting insights that I just wouldn't have thought of.
Agreed. Yeah. I try to get them to bring that to the table. I remember feeling that way the first time I taught adult and aging psych, and I was like, just so you all know, this isn't my area of expertise. Like, I told them on day one, I was like, just so you know, like, not my area of expertise. Just if you might have questions, we'll learn together.
I'm so afraid of being found out that, like, I just have, like, this perpetual sense of imposter syndrome that I wouldn't even be able to muster saying something like that.
I just own it. Because, you know what? Like, it feels so much worse to, like, be like, yes, I am all-knowing on this topic. And then they ask you something and you don't know the answer. And I try to, like, I think that's also important to model for students that, like, I don't care if I have a PhD. I say all the time, I don't know. Like, I don't know the answer. Let's look that up together. Let's learn about it together or figure it out, or I'll do some research on it. Because they always think that, like you are the expert that is imparting knowledge upon us. And it's like, no, that's not really what's happening. Like, I have some information, but, like, I usually just look stuff up. That's... That's the skill we gotta learn.
Well, that was a good discussion. I mean, if you guys have anything else to say, I think probably we should transition to talking about Lisa's excellent and ingenious experiment. So yeah, that was a great discussion. I've learned after this discussion that I may be a bit, you know, I should probably change the way I think about student feedback. Because, you know, unlike you, I do often, like, my first instinct is to say, well, who's this person like?
I had the same,
I know what I'm talking about,
same
but,
feeling.
You know, yeah. But I think you're right. Like, we can't possibly be an expert in everything we teach, mm-mm, right? I mean, that's just not the way this thing works.
Nope.
Right? So yeah, great. So what we'll do is we'll take a break and then we'll be back. Thanks. Today, we're going to be discussing Lisa's paper that examined the role of object labels on infant visual attention. So the study itself was quite a clever study that used multiple methods. For me, before I at least describe the experiment, I will say that this is actually one of the better experiments I've read. Not only is it a true experiment in every sense of the word, there's random assignment. There's a control group, the statistics are tight. Like, this is a really, really nice experiment.
Yeah,
multiple methods. And so if you teach research methods like I do, or stats like I do, this would be an ideal paper to show your students as an example of what good science looks like.
Yeah.
And what careful science looks like. So I will say that from the outset that I really, really appreciated the nature of the paper and just how sciencey and how true of an experiment experiment with multiple methods it was. So with that, I'll sort of let Lisa give us a brief overview of the research and in particular sort of what motivated this study.
Yeah, well, so this work is the most recent training study that our lab has conducted, and we've conducted several of these that we call training studies in the first year of life, primarily between 6 and 9 months of age. And so I started working on this to try and better understand the development of perceptual narrowing with face perception, which is essentially that infants tend to be more broad in their ability to distinguish faces early on in development, and that tends to become more specific to the kinds of faces that they see in their environment a lot by 9 or 12 months of age. And so one of the things that we started with, actually while I was in grad school, we started just sending infants home with books of non-human primate faces. And we essentially showed that the six-month-olds could distinguish non-human primate faces and human faces equally well. And then by 9 months of age, they seem to decline in their ability to tell the difference between the non-human primate faces.
I love this research, by the way. This is with Pascalis, right?
Yep. So that's where this work started as. And then we followed that up with some names in the books. And in this case, we had a couple of different names. So we thought, we were trying to better understand what role the label plays in directing learning in this case. So if you had individual labels, like We Learn Faces, where everybody has a name, how do we use that name, and how does that impact our attention or our perceptual representations? And versus a category. So in face processing, you can imagine that there are a lot of faces where you learn the names. So the faces that you see a lot, you learn the names. But the faces that you don't see a lot or you don't interact with, you might not learn their names and might be learning them slightly differently over the first year of life. So we wanted to make those comparisons, and that's what we call kind of the individual label versus the category label comparisons. And we did that with the non-human primate faces in published it in 2009 and 2010, and essentially showed that the individual level labels led to better discrimination and more specificity in the neural response. So they seem to distinguish the faces. And in the neural task, we used upright and inverted faces, which is an index of holistic processing. So then we went on to do this with strollers. So anybody who might be familiar with perceptual expertise literature in adults, they use cars quite a bit. And so we kind of thought it would be cute to use strollers
for babies.
Yeah, nice. For babies. So we wanted to...
Baby vehicles.
But we also wanted a comparison that was similar in to faces. Strollers have a seat and wheels and
there's a very canonical structure to it.
Exactly. Yeah. Just like faces do. And so we use that as a comparison, and we found almost the same effect or very similar effects in terms of the individual labels led to better discrimination of those. And then in this recent paper, we used novel computer generated objects called shine bugs. In this study, used both eye tracking and EEG to try and see before and after we send infants home with a book with these different labels on for 3 months, whether they learn differently the category versus learn the visual stimulus or treat the visual stimulus differently if they're given a category label versus an individual label.
For the... for the listeners, Lisa, can you give them an example of what you mean then by the individual label versus a category label, like in the context of when they're, when kids are reading this book, maybe with parents?
Yeah. So in across a couple of studies, so in the stroller study, for example, you'd see six, you'd have a book with six pictures of strollers in it, four or six, I think six. And they'd all be different strollers, but you know, the word would be stroller, 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 stroller across all the books. And in the individual condition, we had made up names that differed across all of the conditions. And but they weren't proper level names. Like they weren't names that you would, that people would have, for example. They were just sort of random made up names in that case, but they were all individual names. And then in this study, in the child development study that we're talking about now, we used individual level names. So we used things like Boris and I can't even remember all the names that we picked. I think we had Boris
and Harry,
Jamar, and Harry, and Lewis. Yeah,
yeah, I appreciated the Jamar. I was like, hey, that's a bit, you know, they're being inclusive. Throw some Jamals in there, you know. Yeah. I appreciate that inclusivity.
They're very diverse names. I appreciated that too. They're nice.
And so we had the same exact objects with category labels versus individual labels, and examined how infants are attending to these stimuli before and after this 3-month training period. So essentially, you know, we showed that the individual labels lead to better attention and better discrimination using different methods.
Which I thought was just quite just remarkable that, so it's not, so I will say, as you just mentioned, the infants, you know, at 3 months of age, they were randomly assigned to these different conditions, and the babies who were in the individual level training condition, as well as in the category level training condition, they received training, but it wasn't extensive. It wasn't every day for every hour of the day. And so when you sort of, the sum total of the experience was actually quite minimal. And so the fact that you're showing, the fact that you showed, for example, that babies in the individual level condition not only were able to integrate novel stimuli from the same category into their existing categories, but recognize when they're shown a novel instance that differs from what they had seen, like the fact that they can, and I should mention, as you mentioned, these were funny looking stimuli. So I was looking at the stimuli before I read the paper, I challenged my, well, once I got to the methods, I challenged myself to be able to pinpoint like what those individuating features were, and I couldn't. And so the fact that these babies were able to do this with such minimal training to me is remarkable. And it shows up both in their looking. So in the paper, the term that they that was used was dwell time. And so it shows up in their dwell time, and it also shows up sort of in their brain responses. And so the babies in the individual level category condition, so one of the tasks I really liked was the oddball task that you had, which for those who do infant research, this is somewhat similar to a discrimination experiment where the babies are repeatedly shown something over and over again from, it could be the same thing. And then on some trials are randomly shown something that differs very subtly. Mm-hmm. And the fact that the babies who received individual level training detected these very subtle differences that I couldn't see just based on scanning the stimuli was impressive. And it wasn't true for the category condition, nor was it true for the no category training or no training condition.
And so just to like, also again, I think for background purposes to say, like, the reason why you think you're seeing this is because by giving something an individual label, that's like directing infants to pay more attention to like nuanced or small subtleties of a stimulus, because it's sort of cueing them into like, this is an individual item, right? Like, so it's, or I don't know if I'm describing that right or interpreting the way that you would say that the best.
Yeah, and in this case, there were multiple features. So one of the things that we did with the stimulus set is to design it so that if you had a category of five different, of these shine bugs that were in a species that we call them, it could be, you know, that the tail usually on five out of six of them is going to be pointy, But on one of them, it's not going to be pointy, but it'll still be part of that species. But then there's also, you know, pattern changes and other features that we differ, that we altered a little bit. So it wasn't something where you could, you know, as an adult, use a rule, like always look at the tail and figure out whether the tail is there to do it.
That's where I went wrong.
Yeah. So
I was like, there has to be one thing that distinguishes these guys, right?
Yeah. And we've done these studies with adults and obviously use much harder. You know, we've got 10 different species, 2 different families, and we do training with adults with these also, to try and train perceptual expertise.
Yeah.
And so it's not, you can't use rules. You could if you made the stimuli, I could use rules because it's either this or this or this. But it's not very easy to learn what those are.
But that, again, that label is that what we think, giving an individual label that hones us in on looking at more of these specific features. So that infants are like attending to them more. So when they're in this discrimination task, like we see that they're able to do that discrimination better because they've hypothetically been paying attention more to these individual details during those training sessions versus kids that are getting this category label that's somehow cueing you into like, this, all of these are one thing. Maybe I don't need to like pay such detailed attention.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. And I think that, you know, I mean, it makes sense, right? Like if you have a dog and your neighbor has a dog and your other neighbor has a dog and they're all golden retrievers, for you, because you have a dog, it's going to be more important for you to tell the difference between those three. But for somebody who lives down the road who doesn't have a dog, they're just going to say those dogs over there. You know, I mean, it's kind of just the task.
Yeah, try to tell my dog that she's a dog and she'll look at you like like you're crazy. She doesn't think that she's a dog.
She's not a dog. No.
She's a human, right? She sleeps with she sleeps with me. She eats my food. You know,
yeah.
I mean, very close.
I have a zoo full. I'm sure they're
no, but that's absolutely right. Yes. I mean, and it makes a lot of sense. What I found to be also impressive is that you were able to get the study done in a year, like with 6 and 9 month olds with these multiple measures. I'm like, how the hell? I can't even. There's a study that I'm still doing. No joke. That I'm still doing, that I've been doing with young infants, that I've been doing for probably 3 or 4 years now. Like, and I'm like, she was able to get this done with this many infants using these procedures. Like, where did you get your babies, please?
Yeah, yeah. Well, this particular study was collected at the University of Massachusetts. And we had, in Massachusetts, we had access to birth records. So we would send out mailings, and we had a pretty good, the families who lived in that area were more willing to come in for studies of that, this nature.
To be honest, I think what was more impressive to me, Dion, is that you got like a lot of parents who were compliant in doing this training at home with their babies. Like that's the way.
I tell my parents to sit down in a chair for a 5-minute habituation experiment. They look at me like I'm crazy. And it's like, what? So yeah, that's, I agree.
Yeah.
I was very impressed by that. So I will say reading this, I thought was super interesting to me, and again, I always like say, here's me practicing my not knowing things of saying like I'm not an infant researcher. So what this tied into for me though was thinking about my interest in like early childhood and through middle childhood is in, I study a lot of like stereotyping and prejudice. I studied children's like thoughts about traits and categories generally. So that's where I was like really pulled into this, and I was like, whoa, this is really cool, like showing that labels this early on, like category labels, are really influencing the things that babies pay attention to. So I was wondering, like, do you see that connection? Like, do you think that is something that's happening, that, or is like, I hesitate to use the word precursor, but like that's what I think I used. Do you think that this is some like early process that's influencing children's category creation later, or the way they think about social groups, or do you see what I like? like, yeah, it's so reinforcing. Like, if already labels direct my attention, and then it's like reinforces these ideas that I have about categories, and then is that like why we are like, what's going on there? What do you think? Sorry, that's like five questions in one. I don't know. I was just so excited.
No, that's okay. I have multiple answers. But the first answer, I think, so Julie Marcant and I just in 2018 published a paper in Current Directions in Psych Science where we put out a model of how we think the development of face processing and face biases develop and the mechanisms that kind of influence it. And it's one of those models that, you know, everybody... Not, and when I say model, I mean like.
I'm excited. I'm like, you have a model.
That goes to that. I had to. I'll clarify that. I'm sorry. Yeah. I would love it if someone would do an actual model, but this is just like.
I was on the box train. I knew where you were going.
Yeah, see, when I hear model, I think of instantly computational. That's what, so it's my bias.
Yeah, nope. I will give you, if you want to do any modeling of my data, I will give it all away.
That's funny.
I am happy to do that. But we really thought through sort of all the different kind of steps of how something like this might happen. And we do think that, that it is one of the things that might contribute to later stereotypes or, you know, prejudice or other kinds of things because it's based in experience, you know? So it's just like when we learn a language and, you know, the whole thing about, you know, phonemic development, like we're not going to learn the distinctions between sounds that aren't present in our native language and in our environment. The same way that we're not going to learn to distinguish faces as well when we don't have to do that as a part of our environment. And I do think that we form concepts in the first year of life of people and places and animals and objects, and that those have cascading effects, I guess, on later development. And so I would say that they are definitely likely connected. We did do one study where we brought the babies back who did the stroller study and the non-human primate face study. We brought some of them back at 4 years of age, and we found that the ones who were in the individual condition actually had kind of more adult-like face processing. It didn't matter if it was strollers or non-human primate faces, just the individual labels seemed to influence their face processing later. And so we published that in Developmental Science, I think 2015, maybe.
I have so many papers to look up after this episode is done recording.
But it was a smaller sample. You know, a lot of these studies, one of the critiques, and I am well aware of the critiques, is that the sample size, they're smaller, and we're working on that a little bit now. This particular sample size was small, you know, I think because we were using multiple methods and we needed to get good data from multiple methods. And
you mean
and
that's you really couldn't hard. Test 300 infants in your training study with ERP?
And I moved, right? Like I moved in the middle of this grant. So we ended a little bit earlier, and then, you know, in our last study, I was like, we're going to have the largest sample size ever. And then like COVID hits.
Yeah.
Like, well, maybe we'll have a small sample again, you know? So there's certain things that, it's like things happen.
Small sample's okay. Pandemic is okay.
So before you say something, Candy, I wanted to sort of piggyback on your point. I think what you had said about sort of the you know, your comment about the individual labels made me think of something that was somewhat related. And so, you know, we often, we've all taken social psychology, and perhaps you've even taught it. I haven't taught it, but I've definitely taken it. Mm-hmm. And one of the concepts we learn, of course, is this idea that, you know, Western cultures are individualistic, and Eastern cultures tend to be collectivistic. And so that made me wonder, based on when you were talking, it made me wonder if you were to do a corpus analysis of the kind of language that infants in these two different societies get, whether or not you also see differences in the kind of label. So are you going to see a large proportion of category-like labels in Eastern cultures and more individual-like labels in our kind of culture? I think that would be one prediction that you might make given the kind of data that we're talking about here. Perhaps, you know, some of this difference when we talk about at adult age of, you know, us being individualistic versus them being collectivistic, maybe this has to do with some part of the kind of language that infants see. And you just mentioned that some of these effects are long lasting. And so there's every reason to think perhaps or to predict that you might see some of this effect. It might be a function of the nature of the input that they receive, the language input early on. Do you have any sort of thoughts? That wasn't a part of, you know, we didn't discuss it beforehand, but it just made me think.
Yeah, I mean, I would say I don't know the answer from the language side of things, but it's a really interesting question. One of the things that we haven't done that I really want to do, if someone would just give me some money to do this, it is to record what's happening during the reading session, right? So like, not only what are individual differences across cultures, mm-hmm. but just within parents and you
families
know,
and
families and stuff, you know, what are the factors that lead parents to be more verbal or use more gestures or, you know, are they doing things that are qualitatively different when there's an individual label there versus when there's a category label there versus when there's not a label there. And so that's one thing that I think would be really interesting to look at and might differ, you know, within cultures, but also across cultures pretty significantly. And then, you know, I do know that with face processing, there's some differences in terms of how people strategically, I guess, look at faces. So there's some eye tracking differences between cultures, depending on how the faces are used in those cultures. So I wouldn't be surprised if there were cross-cultural differences in these factors, because I think that they're going to be just individual differences more generally.
Gotcha.
That's what I was going to say. Yeah. Is there like any data showing that like certain people, I feel like this has to be a thing already, like again, related to something like essentialism or work with like how parents talk to kids, like that some parents tend to use more individualistic language or versus category labels. Is that a thing that exists or that we know about? Cause I would be interested in that. Like, like GoPro a baby, but not like really GoPro, just like,
well, that's what they do. They put GoPros. I mean, that's what Linda Smith does. Yeah.
Like, I just want to hear what, like, do parents tend to use, certain parents tend to use lots of category labels to refer to people or objects or things versus individual labels. And like, see, I'm like linking to my thing of like, to me, that's the more that we use these individual labels, then we're thinking of more like honing into things like perspective taking or theory of mind, that like, I'm really trying to think about an individual person. Your work is really looking at like the visual side, but even what that's maybe cueing people into thinking about, what infants are thinking about, I feel like that could be really powerful if parents are using lots of those labels, those category labels, then I'm not going to really think about you as an individual person or try to think about your mental states or your emotions and engage in perspective taking, which we know is really helpful for mitigating bias. So maybe there's like some connection there with language.
Yeah. I apologize. You cut out for second on my video take here. So I missed just that last maybe 30 seconds. So I apologize.
No, it's okay. Just could it be something about using those category labels that links to how we think about other people's mental states too? That like, if you talk about people in categories, I'm less likely to try and think about your thoughts or feelings or perspective on the world. Whereas if you use those individual labels, then I'm more likely to key into that.
Yeah. I would predict that is what's happening. And, you know, I I think that infants and children self-organize around the information that's in their environment. And if you know, parents are using categorical labels a lot, then they, you know, that may be what they're learning more about. I definitely think there might be some developmental differences, mm-hmm. though. So one of the hypotheses that I have that I don't think, well, I have a lot of hypotheses that that people don't agree with me on, but I'm not sure if this would...
Welcome to this particular podcast. Right.
Yeah. Hypotheses so, people don't agree with.
I know. So I... but I... You know, one of the things I've been thinking about lately is whether the development of using categorical labels for learning or learning categories versus the individual labels, whether that follows a different developmental trajectory. So we find all these effects for individual labels between 6 and 9 months of age. We find no effects for category labels, but we clearly know that categorization is important after 12 months of age.
But the effect you're showing would seem to fall naturally out of a prediction one would make if, in fact, infants are forming categories, right? So if you're, so just to be clear for the listener, one of the findings, and again, correct me if I'm wrong, but one of the findings from the paper was that the infants who were given category labels, that when they were given this oddball task, where their task basically was to isolate the oddball, they failed to do that. But that's, I think, what I would otherwise predict if they're processing more holistically stimuli.
But it doesn't differ from the control.
That's
the,
so that's right. So that complicates the matters a little bit. But ignoring that.
I agree with you.
But notwithstanding that minor point, you know, the pattern of data with the category children would seem to be quite consistent with what I would otherwise predict if they're processing stimuli holistically.
See, the trick is that you would have to come up with some type of task where the category would make a different prediction than the control. Whereas in this case, I think if they are processing it as a category, they would respond.
Well, to be fair, I don't know to what extent we can actually, rejoinder to your rejoinder, I'm coming back at you. So you had mentioned, so you just said, you know, they didn't differ from the control. Well, so one of the criticisms I do have of this paper, but again, it could be my misreading of the paper, is that the control condition wasn't really a control condition in the way I would have thought about it. So let me be clear. So you have two conditions that have some kind of training. You have a third condition that has no training, and also the type of label that's used differs too. So the control condition in the study differs in two ways from both of the experimental conditions. So comparing the results across these two cases, it's not clear what conclusions one can make, just given that the control condition differed in more than one way from both of the conditions. So that's my point, back to your point.
I can address that. I do think that that's an important issue. I think in an ideal world, we would have had a control condition that had 6-month-olds who were sent home with, you know, some random thing that's not related to what they were tested on. And then we would bring them back at 9 months of age. And we did do that in 2009 and 2010 with the strollers and the monkey faces that we were using. We had, we did do that in 2009 and 2010, and basically found no difference when we were doing visual paired comparison task and an inversion task between that condition and the category condition. So in all of our studies that we've looked at that comparison, and we haven't done it for all the studies, primarily just because in order to move things forward a little bit, we're adding information, we're adding tasks to it, and then you just get to a point where you can't do it. You can't do all of it anymore with babies. So you have to kind of pick and choose. But, you know, I acknowledge that I think it would have been better to have a control group in this particular case that had no labels or just no books. But still,
that was interesting. So I was just thinking more what you just said, no labels, but still a book. Now that's a silly thing to have a parent do, to give a kid a book with nothing in it. But like in the truest sense, that's what you would almost have to do, I guess.
Well, you could give them like the visual. You could give them even the visual stimuli, but no labels, right? Like no individual labels, no category labels. So they have the same visual experience, but no label that directed their attention.
And we did that in our earlier studies. The issue with that, which is sort of interesting and kind of got me thinking about parent effects, is that half of those parents did not come back. They were like, we just didn't do this. Like we, you know, they were really just not, compared to all of our other studies, when we send babies home with just pictures, a lot of times the parents would just hand them the books and walk away. And then, you know, they didn't.
Why not have RAs go like frequently? To the houses. I'm sure it would be quite expensive, but that at least would.
Look at Dion. Like, why don't you just do this really intense, expensive study where you send RAs?
This is where it's okay to say, why don't you shut the fuck up?
I'll put that in my next grant, and then maybe I'll recommend that you review it. How about that?
Yes, please. Is there a situation though, Lisa, where you could devise a task? So like I think that one of the key points here is that like here the prediction would be that the category label they're looking wouldn't differentiate from the control. So if you wanted to understand like are they using this category label in a special way, is there a way to do that, or have you done that, or has somebody done that?
We haven't done it with this age group. I mean, people use categorization tasks for mostly looking time type categorization tasks. Yeah. And I think that that's what needs to be done.
Sure.
Everything that we've done is just looking at like individuation and attention and, you know, being able to discriminate amongst exemplars, which I feel like, you know, that's what we're training them to do. So maybe it makes sense that they're not going to do anything with category labels.
Yeah.
But it's also unclear whether the absence of category labels in the condition where they don't have anything is because they automatically treat those as categories, or because having category labels doesn't differ from
not having a priori test.
I think we don't.
You just need a simple.
Yeah, we don't have the answer to that. One thing that we would like to do that we've just started. So we've just started using a technique with EEG called SSVP, where we can present images or conditions at different frequencies. And so we can, present a picture of, let's say, like your mom's face at 6 hertz, and then a stranger's face will pop up, you know, every fifth image. And if you can, if your brain is, you know, distinguishing between those images, you should get a peak at 6 hertz and then another peak at about 1.2 hertz, which is where that image is coming up. And so there's a way to do that where you could design the task where you have, you know, the 5 stimuli or the 6 stimuli that you have just differ by individual versus differ by a category, for example. And then you can see whether category training actually, I don't want to say improves category, but leads to, distinguishing the categories in that way. And I think that with novel objects, that's a pretty powerful way to do it. The other thing that we've been doing recently is overlaying 2 stimuli on top of each other and then flickering 1 at 5 hertz and 1 at 6 hertz. And then we can go into the neural response and just look at whether there's peaks at 5 hertz and 6 hertz. We can see which one they're attending to more. We can see whether they're switching between the two and whether the phase of the response is changing over time. Becoming more consistent or more variable, and how that changes with age. So I'm hoping that we can start to address some of the questions between category learning and individual learning, and whether there are developmental sort of, you know, trajectory differences in when they're better at using, or it's a more important task. You know, maybe from 6 to 9 months, the most important task is to learn people, and that includes learning a name. And so that's what they focus on. Whereas when they're a little bit older, they've already accomplished that task, and now they're trying to categorize everything, and that might change their perspective, or I guess their focus on what they're learning. So I mean, that's just a prediction that I have. I don't know, and I think you're right, Dion, that the fact that we found generalization in all of these studies to novel exemplars would suggest that there's some kind of category learning that's happening. So I think it's still an empirical question, to be honest. At least in the first year of life, I feel like that there's still some research to be done.
You still have a job. You're good. You're gonna. Got plenty of stuff.
Here's a question that occurred to me in reading this paper, which is interesting because I've read quite a bit of your work, and this question never really occurred to me, but it occurred to me for some reason when I was reading this particular paper. And the question is sort of, what are the implications of these data for non-sighted deaf children? Like, you know, does that mean that they're completely at a loss? And then secondly, and relatedly, you know, this really starts to get at the nature of the mechanism. Why exactly are the labels themselves mechanisms that are directing, you know, so I've started recently thinking about mechanism at different levels. So you have the more proximal mechanism, you have the more distal mechanism. So here, is it the case that the label is a distal mechanism that's cueing some more proximal mechanism, like, I don't know, whatever it is, and that itself is directing attention to these individuating features. And so if that's the case, you know, maybe non-sighted individuals wouldn't be at a loss. But I guess the more general question is, what are the implications of these results for children who aren't sighted?
Yeah, I mean, like I said before, I view development as sort of a continual process of self-organization, and that you'll use the systems and the tools that you have available to accomplish the task. So in people who are not sighted, I would predict that they would just use a different tool to complete that task. So probably, you know, voices would play a big role, and, you know, maybe texture mm-hmm. or other kinds of things might be really important to learn differences between people. And so I don't know the answer. I'm just predicting what I would think would happen. But I think that happens for a lot of, you know, we know that the brain remaps to areas of the auditory cortex remaps to areas of the visual mm-hmm. cortex. So I think that it's pretty flexible in the way that you then just sort of use what's available to you in the environment to learn these distinctions. And if it's not important to learn those distinctions, mm-hmm. then you don't learn them.
Right. But in this case, then we might see that these labels in non-sighted children would guide their, like, other types of attention. Like, if they don't,
search
they can't direct their visual attention.
Like, yeah.
Yeah, like mm-hmm. some type of, like, more, like, exploration, yep. like you said, maybe texturally or feeling something or listening more intently to distinctions yep. between sounds versus, like, you know, cognitively categorizing them sort of as one thing, like, you know, as one group yep. of sounds that are not always identical, but that they're one category. So that's an interesting sort of prediction to make, and that maybe this yep. is more of a, dare I say it, general mechanism of directing attention that comes from labels.
Well,
yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. I'm on the general mechanism side of almost everything. Yeah. So.
I am to a fault. Right. I am perhaps to a fault. I don't know. I haven't been proven otherwise. I haven't been convinced otherwise. Not yet. Well, I mean, the world is so rich. That's beside the point. Yeah. Okay. You know, there's lots of opportunities to learn. As we talk about on each episode, I mean, you have learning starting in the uterus, right? So these claims of innateness, we'll get to that in a few minutes. So, yeah, do you have any questions?
Well, yeah, I have my like other question, big picture question that came out of this was like, okay, so we have, this is like my brain trying to wrap around like 6-month-old infants that are like reading these stories and like experiencing the world and learning language. And like, so if they're treating these individual labels different from category labels, like, how is it that you think they're doing that? Like, what is it special about the category mm-hmm. label itself? And in my thought, in terms of trying to take apart from what was in the study, I was like, okay, well, is it really that a category label in itself is something special? So
Is it the syntax? Like, it's not the category labels, the syntax that specifies right, so category
like,
label.
In this study, it sort of referred to the category labels as wadgens, maybe is our category, our novel category, right? So like wadgens can somersault. This is a wadgen versus in your individual labels, they're like specific names. So, you know, this is Lewis. He can jump very high. This is Harry, you know. So is it something really about the syntax of like how we structure a category label, or is it simply that in the individual label, they're just hearing different words?
Wait, to be
right, they hear
to be clear on the first trial, there's no information to the infant that this is either a category label or an individual label. It has to be like in order for them to be able to make the inference right that this is a category label, you have to integrate across trials, right? Because in that first trial, I could either
I'm talking about the books. I'm talking about in the books themselves in the training. Oh,
but. They were given auditory. What do you mean?
Yeah. So, I'm, okay.
Maybe I'm not.
Let me re-clarify. Yeah. Is it special that in the training, like the category labels themselves are phrased in that way, like as a category, like this is a blank, you know, blanks do this, whatever that category is. It's the same word that they hear every time in the training versus if we're talking about the individual label, their names, specific names. Does it really matter that they were specific names or just that they heard many names? Does that make sense what my question is?
Yeah, yeah. I think, you know, we started with just names. And one of the critiques that we got was that we weren't controlling for what parents were doing and what they were saying. And so, you know, some parents would come into the lab and say things like, oh, you know, we named this one Princess. You know, and this one, and so it's like that, so there was some, you know, worry that we're just sending them home with books with instructions and a calendar and they mark it down if they did it. And then they, you know, read the book to them and then we didn't really control anything. And so one of the things that was criticized is that we weren't controlling things. And I thought, well, let's add these stories to try and control a little bit more what's happening. And then ask parents to just read the story to them to see whether it, and, you know, we still didn't record these sessions. So we don't know whether parents did this. They just marked a, you know, on the calendar that they did it. And so it still could be that parents do something different in those cases. But, you know, that's the reason why we went to the stories. The syntax does differ across these two. And this was something that Sandy Waxman brought up to me once that maybe it's the syntax that's driving this. And maybe in those other studies, parents are still using that syntax, that differs and that's driving that. And, you know, I don't know the answer to that. I think that's definitely a possibility. But one thing that we have done more recently is, brought 6-month-olds and 9-month-olds into the lab and just did training on the computer, which might have been what Dion was thinking about, where we had the labels, you know, we had each infant did category labels and individual labels, and then we tested them on discrimination of that. And we did find that both 6- and 9-month-olds do that. And they use, actually, we didn't use category labels in that study. We had a sound, like a white noise sound that we used instead of the category label. So we just had an individual sound and then a white noise sound that was paired when they were learning. And with the individual label, both the 6-month-olds and the 9-month-olds did it, but it took the 6-month-olds a lot longer. Mm-hmm. So they learned over time in this study. It wasn't until the second half of trials where they showed the difference, and the 9-month-olds showed the difference much earlier. But in terms of mechanism, you know, I really think that this is a lot of attention is what is happening here. And the ways that we direct infant attention is going to lead them to encode information differently. And so if we're, you know, and labeling is one way and maybe one of the better ways to direct infant attention. But you can imagine that gesturing or, you know, I think periods of joint attention are likely probably pretty important during learning, and learning might occur at higher rates, I guess, when there's joint attention that's happening. But I feel like there's multiple aspects of attention that are influenced by the label. And so, Dion, your question about the proximal versus the distal, I kind of feel like, you know, labels are exerting a top-down sure. impact yep. on these perceptual representations.
Yep. Yeah.
And I think that the mechanism that happens is through mm-hmm. attention.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that over time, that shifts to a more perceptual representation. And my, you know, or it's like a, you know, a familiarity. Mm-hmm. It's like, you know, going from being able to ride a bike, you have to think about every single thing and pay attention to everything, to just being able mm-hmm. to ride a bike. It's probably not the best example, but that's kind of how I think of it, is that it's yeah. a very sort of, you move from just orienting to a stimulus to then, you know, orienting to the stimulus more often. You're starting to build a perceptual representation, and then maybe you don't need to use those top-down attention mechanisms quite as much.
Yeah.
You're building a representation that may be exerting some biases in the system, which lead you to show biases in your behavior.
Sure.
And then that you know, sort of goes on from there.
Yeah.
And so I see this as, you know, and the same thing happens with perceptual narrowing. I'm now thinking that it's not, perceptual narrowing is not one thing that changes from 6 months to 9 months. I actually think that infants are doing qualitatively different things at 6 months mm-hmm. and 9 months. So at 6 months, they're just using their attentional systems to do the task, which allows us to see that they can tell the difference.
Yeah.
Whereas at 9 months, they have built these perceptual representations that bias their attention in these tasks.
That's interesting. Yeah. I wonder what happened then. So this makes an interesting prediction. So if you shift that window from 6 to 9 to, let's say, 9 to 12, and then do the exact same thing, category versus individual level training, would you not see any mm-hmm. difference? I mean, if what you're saying is true, that is that there's a shift from labels sort of exerting this top-down influence to kids forming these categories, mental representations. You know, would you see less of an effect, I guess, for this later window? I mean, like, what, you know?
Well, we did that study. Oh, okay. We're analyzing the data good. Right now. Yeah.
I love when that's the answer. We did that study.
Yeah,
yes.
And I don't have the answer right now because we're still working on it. And, you know, COVID has, like, ruined everything.
As pandemics tend to do.
But
So
we will have the answer to that, I think. But one of the things that I just, and I don't know if other developmental researchers would agree with me here, but 9-month-olds are just like so yep. different. So one of the things mm-hmm. we're noticing is just the variability that we see in 9-month-olds is just so much greater than what we see in 6-month-olds and 12-month-olds. And I feel like that's just because there's so many yep. tasks, right? Like they're like, I'm going to walk, I'm going to talk, I'm going to understand all this stuff. There's just all this stuff that's kind of happening at 9 months that leads to all this variability. Right. But one of the things that we see is that 9-month-olds are, you know, I'm less confident with results from 9-month-olds because when I go in and look at the data, the variability it's a really interesting area. And so one of the things that I want to do is collect a really big 9-month-old sample and then see if I can look at some individual differences there about what's going on. But I would guess that the prediction could go either way. So, right. Like if it's tied to some kind of brain development, mm-hmm. That's happening, then maybe 6 to 9 months is some kind of special period of time, a sensitive period. But if it's just tied to learning, which would probably be my my view of things, you would see it at both as long as it's a new category that you're learning. You know,
sure.
It's like we can train adults to be experts at things.
Yeah.
And I think they start with the same, you know, in the same place and move in the same direction. So you know, my prediction, I would kind of lean towards seeing this at both ages.
Well, I hate to harp on the same thing again, but like to go back to it, what I would be interested to see, and maybe this sounds ridiculous, so like correct me if it just sounds ridiculous, is doing basically the same type of study that you did in this paper, but maybe there's an alternate condition where like they hear the same name in training, but like that syntax is different. So like I just keep, like, introducing you to, like, this is Harry and he likes to jump, and this is Harry and he likes to run, and this is Harry and he does this. And, like, it's the same name that they're exposed to various times, but it's not a category. It's still an individual person or individual label, right? Versus in this condition where they hear, like, a bunch of different individual labels and these category labels that also differ based on syntax. Have you done anything with that to see if that... No, not yet.
Yeah, not yet. No,
I'll be waiting for it. We'll invite you back.
Yeah. I mean, I have to say, these training studies are...
intense, yeah.
Oh, I thought they were quite simple and easy to do and took little work and
run out and do one tomorrow.
Yeah. So when we do a training study, I number one, typically need to have funding.
Yeah.
And number two, I want it to be, you know, sufficiently novel or different from other conditions. So I could see, you know, that kind of a little change, I think, is really interesting and likely does have an effect. The syntax has an effect, and I'm hoping that we can get at some of that by just recording parents and what they do and analyzing the content of those videos. And so we did get some funding to do some of this from NIH. And so I'm hoping that we can do a little bit of that. And we also have the dual eye trackers. So one for the parent and one for the baby. Ooh, where we can see if they're attending to similar things in the book. So that once my lab opens back up, then that'll be something that we're going to hopefully get started on.
Yeah, that'll be awesome. I'll look forward to hearing more about it. It would be really cool. I feel like this is one of those areas where it's just like, and then you could try this, and then you could do this.
Yeah,
like we could come up with 500 things right now, and it will. You have definitely a very fruitful career ahead of you, Lisa.
well, here's a question. So the oddball task, as I described it, again, my description could be off, but the oddball task reminds me a lot of a simple discrimination, a more sophisticated version of a discrimination study. And so I'm sure you're familiar with discrimination studies where basically this really originates, I think, from Paul Quinn's work, where he, and these are, it's a kind of control for his main experiments where he shows the baby the same thing over and over again. So for example, if he's trying to teach babies, just to be clear, if he's trying to teach babies to form a category of cat, and then at test, he shows them a novel cat from the same category and a novel animal from a different category, a dog. The idea is that they form a category, they'll look longer at the dog, right? Because it's novel. And so, of course, one explanation for this, let's say another group of infants failed to discriminate. Well, one explanation could be that they just fail to discriminate stimuli in general. And so what you do is you habituate the baby habituation is you repeatedly show the baby the same image over and over again until their looking time drops, which happens during habituation. And then at test, you show them that compared to something else. And the idea is if they can discriminate stimuli, they should look longer at the new thing, right? And so this oddball task is a kind of discrimination task. And so the question I have is was there a reason for the oddball task as opposed to something like a simple discrimination task?
Well, in this case, the oddball task is kind of an ideal and probably the most used task when you're measuring EEG. So in terms of ERPs. Mm. So when you record ERPs, you have to have very discrete stimuli that are presented for a very short period of time. So you can still do habituation. You just would present the stimuli over and over and over again. But you know, you essentially want the infant to look all the time because you want to record the brain activity, because if they're not looking, then you know, we don't know that the response is actually related to what they're looking at. And so there's some constraints just by using EEG. We have done studies where we've habituated before the EEG and then tested on that stimulus and a new stimulus. And we have shown that babies, you know, they can distinguish faces later on. I think we published that in 2006 in infancy, I think. And so, you know, I think there's multiple ways that we can do the familiarization. And in this case, we thought that the training was sort of like the familiarization. So we just did it. We just tested when they came into the lab what their differences were, you know, without some kind of familiarization.
Sure.
Yeah, that's key. The fact that you want them to look long, like you want them to continually attend. So yeah, that's a good point. I don't do this research, so it's not something I think about.
Yeah, right? Yeah. No, there's a lot of things about EEG research that makes, you know, translating behavioral tasks to EEG tasks kind of difficult.
Yeah. Sure. It's really good that you're doing it though. It's adding, like I said, I love that from the outset of the paper, like these multiple methods, the different ways that you're looking at outcomes, it just paints a really good picture of what's, you know, to really understand what's going on since you have this, and it helps us to get a better idea of what babies are thinking and have a stronger confidence in your results. Like, I mean, to get like consistency, I feel like between your looking time measures and these EEG responses, it's
talk about convergent validity. This is another reason why I love this study.
No, I love doing converging methods, and I feel like it's really taught me a lot, you know, a lot about limitations of looking time studies to do some of this work, because sometimes we find very different things.
What I will say, just, I mean, as if I haven't been lauding enough, another thing I like about this study is that, and this isn't unique to your study, lots of people do this, but what I like about studies that look at mechanism is that one of course, a concern when you're doing a study that's trying to isolate mechanism, you want to make sure that the stimuli themselves aren't familiar. And so I like how, you know, that I like the use of these novel stimuli. It allows you, that's one way of getting at mechanism, of course, because if they show the effect for familiar stimuli, it's hard to know whether or not the effect is driven by the thing in question, the mechanism in question, or because they're just simply familiar. So I really, again, this is just a mark of a good tradesman, or woman.
Yeah.
Right.
Thanks. Yeah.
Well, it's...
Yeah, I think we'll be using the novel stimuli for quite some time, because I think we have this great stimulus set, and we have so much control over it, and so we can ask a lot of really interesting questions.
I've loved chatting with you about this so much, Lisa. Dion, did you have any other questions for Lisa?
Go ahead. Before what?
I was going to say, make sure we don't forget our signature question.
Right. No, I was going to say, more generally, how do you situate this research within the debate the podcast is called It's Innate. So we should at least touch on a little bit. So the question specifically is, where do you situate, you know, these findings in your theoretical perspective within this larger debate between nativist and empiricist, or innateness and domain generality versus domain specificity? And then how has your research...
We can't let you off
right, and how has your research contributed to this debate, if it isn't already obvious?
Yeah, no, I'm happy to talk about it. And I think my answers are sort of evolving over time, but I generally, probably more than most developmental psychologists, would say that there's very little that I think is innate, or that people have convinced me with data would suggest that it's innate. So I know that experience matters, right? Like, I know that because I do these studies and I control experience, and I find that it's important. So, you know, I tend to think that infants sort of, you know, come to the world with these general learning mechanisms like associative learning and statistical learning and habituation, and that they can learn most of what they need to learn with just those mechanisms in place. And some of the biases that we might see, so for example, in face processing, this is a big debate. I tend to be on the side of the learning side of the face processing debate, just because there's these very clear, you know, just because babies, when they're born, tend to look at something that looks like a face more than something that's doesn't have the configuration of a face, doesn't mean that it's an innate preference for faces. necessarily. I think there's a lot of things going on in the visual system. There's different constraints and the development of different pathways that may bias looking in certain ways. And that could lead people to make the inferences that babies prefer to look at faces, but that may not be the reason why babies are looking at faces more. So we know that there's differences in the developmental trajectory between the magnocellular and the parvocellular visual pathways. We know that the magnocellular pathways develop a little bit earlier than the parvocellular pathways. Magnocellular is, kind of general low spatial frequency information, which would be like two eyes above a nose, above a mouth, whereas parvocellular pathways help you kind of distinguish little features like eyelashes and other kinds of things, and that develops a little bit later. And magnocellular pathways focus on the top part of your visual field. So you put those things together and you could have a bias for looking at things that look like faces just based on the development of the visual system. And so I think there's a lot that we can learn from, animal studies and other kinds of, neuro anatomical constraints that are in the system to help us make inferences about things. But I also don't, in my work, you asked whether my work influences this. I don't know that it does, because, I show that learning is important, mm-hmm. but I don't show that, that babies don't have innate something sure. or other. But I, so I'm not sure, and people have asked me this question before, and I used to be a little bit glib yeah. about it and say like, well, I don't care whether it's innate or not. I know experience is important, so I'm just going to study experience. And I understand why people ask that question, but it's just not a question that I, find to be useful in informing mm-hmm. My work. I'm mostly interested in development and how experience impacts learning, and so yeah. that's what I'm looking at. But I would say that I'm on the side of, I think most things can be general, learned by these general mechanisms.
I mean, I think that that's contributing, though. Like, even, I don't think that that always has to be the point. It's like, it's not that I have to prove that something is or is not innate. Like, you're contributing just by saying, like, I can show you.
Exactly.
How even,
it's a sufficiency account.
I think the rejoinder, mm-hmm. Is often that, like, these things couldn't be learned at a particular time. Or, like, there's, that experience isn't enough. But, like, if you're able to show that early experience, even in these cases, like, experiences that are, like Dion said at the very beginning, not very rich. Like, these aren't, like, crazy, like, over-the-top training studies that, like, they're training all mm-hmm. day, every day on something. It's just, like, this is a small intervention that they're doing. And so I think that really does contribute a lot to show that, experience is important and that, like, even small experiences that we have can then really just shift a lot of our trajectory of the things we pay attention to and then what we learn in the future. And that is like those cascade effects that you mentioned, which I think are like often so important. So yeah, I think it's just really interesting to think about.
Yeah. I mean, I think you're right. Like just showing that this works, that experience happens is an important, I do modeling, not because I think modeling is right. I mean, it shows, all models are wrong. And all theories are wrong at some levels, right? And, well, I mean, that's actually, that's as a matter of fact. But I do modeling because I do the kind of modeling that I do because it provides a sufficiency account. It shows that, okay, perhaps, maybe this thing is innate. But what I'm showing is that, the simple mechanism or the simple, mechanism can give rise to complicated patterns of behavior. And so the onus is really on you to prove me otherwise. But I've shown that at least in this case, a more parsimonious account can give rise to the exact same thing that you're attributing to, thousands of modules or core systems or whatever. And I think that is contribution enough. The onus isn't on us to prove our account and then go back and prove their account wrong. It's sort of, I think it's just to provide a sufficiency.
And I mean, and I think that in the end, we all know that, like, there are some things that are likely innate, like, even if it's the most basic of functions.
Mechanisms are innate. All learning mechanisms are innate.
Yeah, but, right. Like, we don't really have, like, I think that's what we come back to a lot, is, like, we just don't have, like, sufficient methods to, like, even try to prove some of those things, disprove them. Or, like, if you say something's innate, like, well, I can't really challenge that. Because, like, I can show you that environment influences that. But I can't say, like, here's my evidence that it is not hardwired into your system, because, like, there's not really a way to specifically test that. So, yeah.
And there's also arguments about what parsimony is, you know? I mean, I've been in these arguments before where I've said, well, this is more parsimonious. And, you know, and a colleague of mine would be like, well, I actually think that this evolutionary, you know, is more parsimonious. And then, you know, it's sort of this back and forth, which I think are useful debates to have, because it pushes your thinking in different directions. Mm-hmm. And so that's, you know, helpful to me. But I haven't read anything within the face processing literature that makes me feel like, you know, face processing is, you know, that you come to the world with this innate ability to look at faces for evolution.
Now, do they have, so the account that you outline is kind of interesting. You know, I don't do brain research, but you talk about Parvencelliner.
Yeah.
And you were saying that those combined, what you said. And those combine to direct infants' attention to the top part of the visual stimuli. So I guess the question I would have is, are there experiments that don't use faces but yet still have stimuli that are organized in this top-down fashion and show that there is more attention up here than down here? And that would, you know.
Yeah. And I think that, so, but that's, you know, there's also then, it leads to the chicken and egg. So do they look at those stimuli because they look like faces? Or do they look at those stimuli because they have these constraints of the visual system? So I still think it, you know, it's hard to
tease apart.
Determine, but there's an Italian group of researchers who have done a lot of this, you know, controlling the stimuli in different ways to see what the preferences are, and find that a lot of factors are actually influencing. So not only is it this, you know, top, more stuff on the top compared to the bottom preference, but there's also a congruency preference. And so there may also be these other preferences, but are those separate preferences that are just driving looking behavior that, you know, are constrained by things like maturation? Or is there some, you know, face detector that's in place? And I think that even though a lot of those studies have been done really carefully, none of them really tell us the answer to that.
Yeah.
All right. Should you do a good job at asking that final question? So I'll let you ask that question.
Okay. We always like to end on a fun note.
Oh, I would have prefaced it like, this is our zinger, just to build it.
This is our zinger. I don't know. It's just like, you know, we talk about all kinds of stuff throughout these episodes and science and heavy stuff, and we like to end by something fun and say, so if you were not, you're like super developmental scientist, you're doing all these great things, but in some alternate reality where you did not go to an amazing program at your university and end up in developmental science, what do you think that you would be doing?
Ha, you know, well, I...
What else might you be doing if you were...
What else might I be doing? I mean, I have to say, I think that I would be in science somewhere. Mm-hmm. The biological sciences, you know, I really love learning about plants and seashells and, you know, like learning all the different kinds of things. And maybe that some of that I think stems from my interest in how people become experts at recognizing things. But I, you know, and I also love reading about other areas of research, you know, like astronomy is just amazing. I would love to see someday write a paper. Yeah.
Write a paper that can... jokes. He's preparing.
Yeah. Somebody that writes a paper that compares like how you image space to how you image the brain, because I think a lot of the problems are the same, and it's so interesting. And so, you know, part of me thinks that I would love to be a science writer. And I've been spending a lot of time recently trying to learn how to better communicate our own research and to, you know, do that with a podcast. And so I think that's something that I'm working on a little bit. And I see these science writers, and I think, and I know some of these science writers from this fellowship that I just finished. And I think that would be so fun to just interview people and talk to them about their findings across a bunch of areas. So I guess I would say, you know, science writer, social influencer.
What gesticulation?
Social influencer.
I'm just kidding.
Expert.
No, I just I think like science writing is really it's fun, and I would love to learn more about all these different fields. Cool. So I would guess that would be probably what I would be interested in.
Awesome. Yeah.
I think that you can still do that.
I know.
Good thing about our job. You can, like, you know what? Next time we talk to Lisa, she's going to have her own podcast. Like, start a science blog. Like, just do it. It'll be awesome.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much, Lisa, for being here and for sharing about your work and about yourself. And I know that all of our listeners have enjoyed hearing about your research, and hope to have you back.